Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Michael and Patty podcast, which is all about living in Prince Edward Island. And it's another absolutely picture-perfect, pretty day in PEI. We're coming to you live on tape, of course, from the Charlottetown waterfront in front of the yacht club, looking out at all the people here on a Sunday morning. Good morning, Patty, and welcome aboard once again. I'm glad to see you've made it to another episode.
Good morning. Yes, it's always so nice to see all the yachts still out in the water. I love the season here on Prince Edward Island.
Okay, enough chit-chat. We're 40 seconds in, and today's topic is not only a topic for this episode of the podcast, it's also a how-to make an offer on a Prince Edward Island property. And this would actually cover just about any province or state because they're basically all the same with small little changes. So we're going to cover what you need to make an offer on a property. We're going to try to do this as quickly as possible, but we're also going to include in the show notes a cheat sheet, which will give you about 17 things that you need to know and you need to send to your agent or broker to make an offer. Now, typically you would email this information or phone it in to your agent, and then they would send the documents out via DocLoop or DocuSign or whatever they use. In some cases, with Patty, because she deals with a lot of elderly clients, she meets them in person.
Yes, I enjoy my clients, and not all my clients that are senior are not able to electronically sign, but some people like that authentic experience and feeling, and they walk away with a courtesy pen. So it's all part of the experience.
Well, there you go. And I know that some of your clients, their idea of a computer is an abacus.
Okay. It's pretty funny.
What do we start off with? Maybe you can cover the first few points here.
So the first thing that's part of an agreement of purchase and sale that you want to make sure is correct is, what is your legal name? I just listed a property a couple weeks ago, and I took the names right off the deed when I was preparing the listing paperwork, and it was her nickname that was on it. So she thought I had made a mistake, and I said, I pulled your name as it appeared on the government site, on your deed. So make sure it is your legal name that is on there, provided to your agent and your contact information.
When you write a purchase and sale, you're going to have all the names of the people that you intend ultimately to have on the deed, and they're spelled correctly, because they're probably going to take that information off the purchase and sale agreement, the lawyer's office, that is. In some cases, you're going to see people write agreements under corporations, or they're going to have a name or corporation, and they're going to add or assignee. We've covered that other podcasts. A lot of vendors don't like that. I would suggest not using or assignee, because it also is a red flag for the banks, because it's used in mortgage fraud. The next thing we're looking for is the property's address. In the case of land, it may or may not have an address. Probably doesn't, unless a building permit has been applied for previously. So you're going to indicate that on there.
Yeah, and along with the property address, that includes the correct parcel identification number.
Correct, the PID number, which every property in PEI has to have. What you're offering on the property. So you're going to have the purchase price in there. For the Americans, we no longer do, at least I don't, contracts in U.S. dollars, because the dollar has started to fluctuate a lot more than it did when it was more common for us to do contracts in U.S. Have you found the same thing?
Yeah, predominantly, and I've been in real estate for 14 and a half years. I found in my early years I would see contracts written in U.S. dollars, but I haven't in about 10 years.
I used to do them all the time. So if you are American, all the denominations are Canadian, so you want to convert that to see what you're dealing with. The deposit, what would you say is a reasonable deposit in North America?
In North America. So again, every province is a little different. The rule of thumb should be approximately 5% of the purchase price. Now on PEI, you're not going to end up typically seeing that. So practice, what you'll see common practice on the island being, is the maximum amount that a person could send an e-transfer, which usually is set at $2,500 to $3,000. So that is usually the minimum amount that I would like to see. But I totally agree along with you, Michael. It is better to get a higher deposit. So I bring back the question to you, why is the deposit so important?
Stepping back to the 5%, the 5% rule is what you'll typically find if you Google what is a typical real estate deposit. I always like to see between 5 and 10%. A lot of times you don't get that. A lot of times, like Patty said, it's going to be whatever the limitation the bank has imposed on their bank accounts for e-transfers, which is usually $2,500 to $3,000, unless you've made other arrangements. As far as the deposit from a vendor's standpoint, if I'm selling something, I look at the deposit as how serious are these people. If I'm selling a house for $850,000, I would take an offer more seriously if there is a $100,000 deposit than $1,500, or at least 5%, $40,000. You don't typically see those big deposits in PEI, but there's no reason you can't ask for them. They're going to have to put money down to get their financing anyway. It may as well be in the trust account so I can nab it if they walk away. I'm going to feel a lot better if things go wrong walking away with $100,000 than I am walking away with $1,500. I do know some professional real estate investors, and I've done the same thing, where you, and this is people that have the money to do this, is you just write a check for the entire purchase price, which for me didn't work out too well, and still turned the offer down.
Now that's, I will just say this, from a buyer, obviously you'd like to be able to put down as minimal amount as you can, just in case things do go sideways, just in case, because life happens. You know, we've had clients that have had heart attacks and they needed to pull out, and, you know, I mean, you're in breach of contract, that's a whole other subject, but whatever the less of the sting is. When you're a seller, you would like to see the most amount. And my rule of thumb with my seller clients is, what would make the sting a little bit more bearable, i.e. are you moving expenses, first and last month's rent, you know, those kind of costs. If your deposit is at an amount that it's still going to upset you, but at least it's not going to leave you in a negative situation, that's what I try to do to protect my seller clients.
I look at the deposit as far as quantitatively, as far as the dollar amount. The further the closing is out, the bigger I want to see the deposit, because risk has increased.
Good point.
If someone's closing in 6 to 8 to 9 months, it's a lot different than someone closing in 5 days. 5 days, I don't care. I haven't lost any time on market. 6 or 8 months, I'm taking that property off the market. I care. The second thing I look at is the vendors, the owners of that property. Are they just moving next door? So they're just going to rent a U-Haul truck for $100 and move their stuff themselves? Or are they going to spend 10 or 20 grand and they're moving to Hong Kong? So that, in my opinion, should be kept in mind as well. What are the circumstances of the vendor and what is the timeline? Having said that, if I'm writing an offer, I still do feel a larger deposit makes your offer look more serious.
Yes, and without you realizing why, especially who would have thought the deposit had so much merit as part of the contract agreement, which is why we're doing this episode. Now, hopefully you understand why your realtor, if you're a seller client, is trying to get that deposit up.
Point number 6 in our little PDF file, again, we will attach to this episode, your lawyer's name. Always a good idea to have this preemptively, so we're not searching for this afterwards, or we get the old, oh, they're still trying to decide on a lawyer 2 weeks later. Meanwhile, this is sitting on my desk and I need to get it off my desk. Know who your lawyer is before you write the offer. If you do need a list of very good real estate lawyers in PEI, contact myself, not Patty.
Your realtor will definitely be able to hopefully provide a few names to you so that you could do your own due diligence and make that decision yourself.
Financing clause. What's that all about?
Those buyers that require financing in order to make the purchase has to get approval from their lender in order to complete the transaction or make the purchase. There is also a deadline that comes with that, and the deadline typically is around 2 weeks. When I see a finance clause with a 3-week condition period, that can send off red flags, unless it is a commercial purchase, because commercial financing does take longer. Or if I see, yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
Typical financing clause is between 7 and 10 banking days. And it basically means you can get the money to buy the property. It's important to know that you can get the financing before you waste the purchaser's time, your time, the vendor's time, both agents' time, potentially lawyers' time. It's very disappointing when you have someone that says to you, oh, I haven't gone to the bank yet.
Yeah, you as part of your financing, you shouldn't just put in your numbers, your income online to a mortgage calculator to determine, oh yeah, I've been pre-approved. You need an approval. You need to go in to your lender.
Pre-approval.
A pre-approval to go in to a finance, whatever your lender is. We usually recommend three. And I think Michael and I mentioned this on a previous podcast. However, that step should already be done because you are taking up a lot of both parties' times, the realtor representative's times, only to find out that you couldn't get financing in the first place.
Right. So the financing clause is one of about four or five common clauses. The next one is the home inspection. What's that all about?
So the home inspection, the reason I paused with financing is because I knew we were going to get into this with the home inspection. So the home inspection clause is allowing a buyer to go in and do their due diligence, go through the home, see if there's anything that you just wouldn't be able to live with, or if the list of to-dos exceeds whatever your budget or what you could afford. I usually tell my clients if there's any structural issues or mold, things, you know, like that, or a very insurmountable list of repairs that they just wouldn't be able to address, then this may not be the property for you. Now, the reason I was going to kind of segue into this a little bit during the financing is, as a listing realtor, and you need to know this as a buyer, as a listing realtor, if I see a finance clause out 2 weeks, no, 3 weeks, and I see the, sorry, as a selling realtor, if I see the finance clause 2 weeks and the home inspection 3 weeks, that sets off a red flag for me that they're not confident in their financing, and that's why they're trying to delay the home inspection and giving themselves extra time just in case they don't get approved. That is the message. Home inspection should be in alignment with your finance clause as a deadline.
In a good offer, I would like to see all the conditions removed within 7 to 10 days, particularly if it's a hot property and we're in prime selling season, say between the spring and the fall. I don't want to see things tiered because, like Patty said, they'll tier them because they don't think, or they're not sure if they get the money, so they don't want to do the home inspection right away. The next clause, go ahead, Patty, you had a comment?
I was just going to say, as a home inspection report, look at it as a to-do list, as if you've lived in the home already for 3 to 5 years. You're not trying to find or discover things on your own. And you know, because usually the reports are really good, you'll know what to do in 6 months, what needs to be addressed in a year, what you should be getting to in the next couple years. So I know the reports can be a little daunting, a little overwhelming when you think, oh my gosh, look at all this stuff. A lot of the stuff is just repairs that are coming up, so not to get too stressed out over it.
And it's not a list of things for the sellers to fix for your benefit, nor is it a tool to negotiate the price down, albeit many people feel it is after watching HGTV because they use it as a major leverage tool. And if you're smart as a listing agent or as a seller, you'll do what I do with many of my properties. I'll have it pre-inspected and then we'll adjust the price based on that home inspection, therefore removing that purchaser's lever to get the price down.
Yes, we do that as well.
No, you don't. It's my idea and you've never used it.
Of course not.
The next clause is something that can be done right away. We get this silly question sometimes, who insures the property? And I believe their mindset is that if it's, say, PEI Mutual insuring the property, they're just going to rubber stamp it and it's going to go through and they're going to reinsure it again. Is that the case, Patty?
No, that is not the case. So an insurance inspection, what that is all about is just making sure that the insurance company providing the insurance has low to no risk when it pertains to usually the heat system within the home. So they are checking for the heat system. They're checking for fireplace, make sure it meets today's requirements. The other thing, since Fiona, they are looking for the how intact the roof is, and is there any signs that the roof had leaked inside, because that also causes a huge responsibility and expense with regards to trying to remedy mold issues.
The major red flags I've seen with insurance inspections, and as I said, just because they're insured with PEI Mutual doesn't mean they're just going to rubber stamp that policy. They're going to come in and they're going to re-inspect it. The major things I found are open sources of fire, like wood stoves and open fireplaces. The other thing would be exposed styrofoam or anything that can burn instantly and kill everybody in the house in the basement, which isn't covered up. Recently, that's what I've seen. With the Fiona happenings, I would imagine, in addition to looking for roofs or asphalt tile installations, they would be looking for foundations, because many of the cottages that disappeared during the hurricane floated away or were blown away because they didn't have an adequate foundation.
If I could say one more thing with regards to insurance, people will say they want to go through their bank or a third party. I'll just give you what I tell all my clients is, if you pick an off-island insurance company who does not have a representative that does the inspection themselves, you assume responsibility of ensuring that form is filled out correctly. And should you need to file a claim, if an I's not dotted or a T's not crossed or you are off in your measurements, you do run the risk of not being able to have your claim approved. So I try to advise clients, best practice would be to pick an island insurance company, because they'll assume the responsibility for all the paperwork. So therefore, you shouldn't run into any problems should you need a claim.
Perfect. Number 10 is septic tank inspections. Or actually, they phrase it as a septic system inspection, I believe, but it's not really worded appropriately in PEI.
Yeah, I would agree, Michael, and I've never seen it worded that way, but you're absolutely right. It's more of a septic tank. And if the tank looks like it's functioning okay, then they are assuming the whole system is.
What they typically do in PEI is the septic tank is going to consist of one or two things in my experience. Patty's experience is going to be different. My experience has been, either it's a cement tank that's buried under the ground and you have to dig 3 to 4 feet below the frost line to get to it, which is a real nuisance because they have to bring in an excavator typically. Or it's a more modern plastic tank, which historically has had one lid. The new ones now have two. And some of the upgraded cement tanks will have a riser as well with one lid. Back in Patty's day, they used to use like a 57 Chevy for a septic system.
I don't think so.
We have had a few of those. So what they're going to do, it's a pseudo inspection, in my opinion. They'll take the lid off. They'll see that the tank is level. They'll see that the liquids are at the level that they should be. If it's cracked, you know, specifically with the cement tank, not so much with the plastic one.
Yeah. And they also determine how much refuse is in that based on when the tank was pumped last. Does that make sense? You know, does it look like the liquids are draining off? So as unpleasant as this sounds, those are the things I wouldn't want the job of the septic company. So good for you guys to do that every day for us, but not my line of work that I'd be interested in. Yeah, so the septic inspections, again, the time period for that would be approximately, again, 2 weeks or so. I wouldn't go much further than 3 weeks. We have no control of the septic companies and schedule. We do our best to allow for the appropriate amount of time without dragging things out too long for a seller. A buyer should be on top of things and getting everything all booked.
So you've just ruined my Christmas present idea for you, which was going to be a helmet, some goggles, and an action cam to go into the septic tank inspection business when you retire. So you're not interested, I take it.
No, that gift will not be received well.
The field, the septic field, the leaching field, I guess is what they call it. I haven't seen anyone inspect those here. I know they do it in other provinces with specialized equipment and dyes and whatever they use. I haven't seen that here. That, to me, would constitute a proper inspection. The other thing you can probably do on your own, and the home inspector will probably do, is just look where the septic field is. If it's brown and icky and there's 6 inches of guck on it, chances are the field's not working too well. Plus, it'd be really stinky.
There is a company that does do inspections where they send cameras down to through the field tiles. So there is one on the island, only one that I am aware of, because I have had a client insist that that be done. So if you're looking for one that does camera inspections and actually does a full service inspection, send us a message. I can let you know who it is.
Number 11 is fixtures and chattels. In other words, in English, what's included with the property? There are some things that are common sense and are indicated on the purchase and sale agreement. Those things that are screwed into the wall. Those appliances that are bolted in, like dishwashers and bolt-in microwave over-the-range hood jobbies. But basically, what you're going to do is you're going to list everything you want with that property. Some people will say, oh, well, it's on the listing agreement that the washer, dryer, fridge, and stove is included, and the dog. But that doesn't mean, in my opinion, that it's included. Some agents will say, well, if it's a full price offer, it's included. What I would say is, you can never disclose and you can never document too much. Indicate on there and be exact as to what you want. If you're looking for the orange Kubota lawnmower that has 121 hours of use on it with a serial number of XYZ, put that on the purchase and sale. Maybe even take a picture of it and add an appendix so you know exactly what you're going to be buying and it can't be swapped out when you have an unscrupulous seller, which is rare, but it does happen probably once or twice a year with us.
Yeah, I strongly advise clients that usually we go through the house once you end up, once you've viewed a few, make the determination this is the home you want. I like a second viewing just to make sure that we now have identified the items that we want to have included. If that is not an option, usually listing pictures are really good to use as a resource, but you want to make sure just because it's on the listing paperwork, maybe you didn't want the washer and dryer and that's why it wasn't included. You don't assume anything is included in, especially since Michael has some great lawyers. If it's not on the contract, it doesn't come with the property.
Which brings up a very good point. Those things that aren't written into the contract, if you have a contract and you have a Schedule B, but you're not saying anywhere that that Schedule B is attached to the purchase and sale, that Schedule B does not apply unless, of course, the Schedule B is written in such a way that it's an amendment which indicates that it is attached. So make sure all your documents are indicated on the first page of the purchase and sale paragraph. What is it, paragraph one or two?
Yeah, that's a good point. We did cover that on a previous episode. But a lot of times a Schedule B or C does come with inclusions. They're outlining the items that they want. Make sure, again, clarity that you're not just asking for a fridge, you're asking for...
And the shed. Ask for the shed because some people are very attached and they're taking it with them, even though technically it's a fixture. I had another guy, which I won't mention, we had a generator that was bolted in, wired into the house, bolted into a cement pad. He argued at closing that that was not included with the house. So it cost my purchaser thousands of dollars, even though we knew he was a not very honest seller. They paid it just to move ahead and get this done. But if that had been in the contract and we knew that we were dealing with someone that wasn't very honest, it wouldn't have been an issue.
Yeah, that's a good point. So even though you may assume that it is a fixture of the property, oh, bathroom mirrors, you might just assume they come. But you know what? They usually lift off a nail today. And I've seen many just take them because they love their mirrors. They got them, whether they're handed down or they bought them at HomeSense. So don't assume bathroom mirrors. It's all these little things that you just have to make sure with chattels.
If it's not in writing on the purchase and sale and it's not attached to the purchase and sale, it doesn't matter what conversations you have had. Next, rental property considerations. If you're buying something and it has tenants, you should indicate whether you are keeping them, removing them. This is particularly important with daily or weekly vacation rentals.
Yes. because the way our contracts are written, they are to be vacant at closing. So if there's no mention of the tenant supposed to be there, even though that gets into a whole other thing with affidavits and that, but you are to assume that the tenants are going to be remaining and all the rental deposit amounts need to be requested that they get transferred at closing between the lawyers.
And that's kind of an interesting side point. In the event that you are kicking a tenant or tenants out because they're paying $800 a rent, you think you can get $1,500 a month rent, you may want to have a conversation with your lawyer and or Island Regulatory Appeals Commission on that, because you could be getting into some big trouble down the road if the previous renters find out that you've kicked them out because of the financial gain and an increase in rent that was illegal.
Yeah, and you weren't honest and you were saying that you were moving in. They are investigating and checking in on these.
Propane tank rentals. Propane tanks are typically not owned. They're rented. They're about $100 a year. And when you write your purchase and sale, you should indicate whether you are assuming it or not. And it's always a good idea to know what company from which that is rented so you can call them and assume that contract and or lease.
Yes, I usually just word it that the purchaser will be setting up their own account with the propane company. And I do have many conversations thereafter to make sure that has been done once all conditions have been removed.
Contingency.
If I could just say one more thing.
Nope,
if you do not set up your account with the propane company, they usually would come back within the month. I have heard of propane tank companies, if you haven't set up a contract, they've tried to reach out to you, they dropped off little memos in your door. Don't be surprised if you come home and there's no tank on your property, because they're not going to leave them there if you're not going to set up an account.
Next, the contingency that you have to sell your house before buying this house, or otherwise known as a 48-hour clause.
This is a fun clause to talk to speak with you about, Michael, because I know we have a little bit difference of opinion. So what this clause is its short form is SOBP, subject to sale of buyer's property. And that just allows the buyer, because of the equity for their purchase going forward is coming from their home, it allows them the opportunity to sell their property. Usually, you know, that their address has to be disclosed. That property should be on the market or about to be flipped onto the market as soon as they have an accepted contract agreement, not waiting a week. Well, now that they found this, we're going to get things started next week. Time is ticking. I just don't think that's best practice. And 48 hours. So if there's a 48-hour, we call it a 48-hour clause, the sale of the buyer's property. So should a seller receive another offer that they deem acceptable to them, they can execute what is called the receipt of another offer to the buyer, and they have 48 hours to either remove that condition and move forward with the sale or forfeit the property because they're not able to complete a sale or attract a sale on their property, and the seller gets to move on, and now the buyer has to find something else.
Therefore, if you're making an offer subject to your home selling, you need to make a decision now that if another offer comes in, are you willing to remove that 48-hour, 72-hour clause that you've inserted for your benefit? Some people will arrange bridge financing. You can make that decision on your own, but you should be prepared for that happening because everybody wants what everybody else has. And a lot of sellers will use your contract as a lever to solicit better, more solid offers that don't have an SOBP. Good?
Yes.
Next is IRAC approval, which we've talked about. Island Regulatory Appeals Commission. This is going to apply in a couple different situations mainly. And that is if you're buying over 5 acres of land or 165 feet of water frontage. Or even if you're an island corporation and you're buying that same allotment, and this is on a cumulative basis, which also includes your past purchases. Anything you'd like to add without getting into a long conversation about IRAC, which is a huge conversation?
I think you pretty much covered the IRAC approval. You can, to save time as a buyer, call IRAC and ask them if the property that you're looking to acquire is in one of their red zones. And if you have intentions to move here to the island, chances are puts you in the good books. If you're just looking to have a land holdings and it's in a red zone, you're probably going to get rejected.
FinTrack. This is the government's latest invention, that it's financial tracking, FinTrack. And what it does is it gives us a requirement to know who we're dealing with. So in the case that we're dealing with somebody coming into the office, writing an offer, we typically want to see their driver's license, and then we fill out a form and fill out a risk evaluation. We're not going to get into all the different facets of FinTrack because it gets complicated, but basically we need to know who we're dealing with, and we'll typically ask for your birth certificate and or passport, particularly if you're a non-Canadian resident. Patty?
Yes, so it is required for your realtor to ask you. They need to identify you. They should identify you in person. There is a risk factor questionnaire that the
So agent, don't look shady. If you're wearing one of these glasses with a fake nose and a hat, you're going to risk, you'd be a high risk.
That's one of the questions is, are they concealing their identity?
Is he wearing fake glasses with a fake nose?
Yes, so they do need to identify you. We have had a lawyer in the past, they may have been a new lawyer, that told a buyer client, this is something that happened in our office about 3-4 years ago, they told a buyer client that they should not be sharing their driver's license information with their realtor, that there was no reason for them to ask for that. That is absolutely false. We do need to identify you the same way as your bank would need to. Your lawyer ends up identifying you just to make sure that you are a valid individual. If you're Canadian, we don't need to keep a copy of your driver's license. We just need to see it. If we are not able to identify you in person, we may need a mandatory identifier for somebody else to physically identify you, fill out the form that they have identified. There's no usually fee or compensation for this. If you are a non-Canadian, we have to have a copy of a passport on file. So yes, your realtor will be asking for a copy of your passport. That is one of the requirements to satisfy our FinTrack obligation or responsibility.
The other thing where this will play into is if you can buy property in the area that you want to buy it, if you're not a Canadian citizen. So it would raise a flag with the agent because of the two-year ban on non-Canadians buying property, right? Which we talked about in a past episode. So that's something to look for as well. Those maps are online.
Yeah, and a part of identifying you with FinTrack is also something called the receipt of funds. So
I was just about to touch on.
Okay.
Stolen my next point.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I could read your mind, Michael. So we just need your account number. We don't need your transit, your branch number. We can't do anything with an account number. We need the bank that you deal with or your financial institution, as well as the name of the person who your initial deposit came from. That's the only reason we're asking. It's not where you're making the bulk of your purchase from. Whatever that initial deposit, whatever account that initial deposit came from, that is the account we need the information on.
And the type of account.
Yes. And if it's a family member that's providing the deposit and not the names on the contract,
there's more paperwork.
We need to identify that person as well. So that is all part of the receipt of funds form.
And finally, the property disclosure form, which is affixed or attached to most listings, and it allows the sellers to disclose any deficiencies with the property. And I think it's probably a good idea before you write your offer, because this may become part and parcel of your offer, that you review the PCDS property condition disclosure form before you're writing your offer in case you have any questions.
Yes, it's the opportunity that the seller has to speak almost directly to the buyer without the realtors involved filtering their interpretation of the home. So I always strongly recommend my sellers fill that out for accuracy of information, and that people cannot misconstrue perhaps their interpretation of something that is existing within the home.
And it would be a good idea to give that PCDS, a copy of it, to your home inspector as well, so he can go over any points that have been indicated or reiterated or indicated as defective. And I think that's about it. So the cheat sheet.
I was just going to say one more thing with regards to the property condition disclosure statement, because I have many people that say, well, it's mostly relevant to a structure. It doesn't apply when it's land. Yes, I agree. Right now, our system sucks. We should have one PCDS for residential properties or properties with structures, and we should have one with land, but we do not. So what we're using, what we currently have, that second page does provide a lot of information with regards to covenants and right-of-ways, and is there any buried oil tanks? You know, is there any concern with what the property was used for? So even if it is land, I still get my seller clients who are listing their property with me to fill it out just so that that second page instills confidence in a buyer that this seller has disclosed as much as they possibly could for the property, which instills confidence in the buyer moving forward to make that purchase.
Good point. So for the cheat sheet for this, you can download it in the show notes. And while you're tinkering around in there, make sure you do give us a review, a star rating, and make sure you follow or subscribe to the podcast so we can double our listenership from one to two people. And yes. Other than that, I think that's covered it fairly well.
I think we've covered what you should expect. Now, there's a lot more conditions within the contract, but these are like the highlighted ones that really the parties have an opportunity to do their due diligence. We didn't cover water test. The water test is at the seller's. It's their responsibility to do the water test condition, but at least it gives you a pretty good idea of what your contract is going to consist of. Agreement of purchase and sale usually has all the legal stuff. Schedule A is where I always say has the meat and potatoes, which most of these conditions that we've covered today will be included in.
Perfect. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. If you are one of our podcast listeners, everyone have a great day. And we look forward to bringing more juicy facts and figures and stuff in the future about PEI real estate or PEI in general. And if you have any questions about either one of those subjects, feel free to reach out to Patty and I via text or email or telephone.
Have a great day, everybody. Until next time.
Bye for now.